This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have a host discussion about recent revelations in the continuing saga of U.S. torture.
Revelations is one word, Heidi, but sham, diversion, and hiding the ball is really a better way to describe the so-called recent revelations of CIA torture program.
We'll talk with the son of host Michael Ratner, Jake Ratner, who's just returned from several months in Bolivia, and before that, a few months in Cuba.
Jake worked in prisons and has a lot to say about Bolivian socialism and Cuban socialism.
Stay with us.
Heidi Boghossian, Michael Ratner, you've obviously been following the stories in the New York Times in the last several days about how Attorney General Eric Holder is reconsidering the whole torture situation and has appointed a prosecutor looking into it. Is this a good or a bad development or something else?
It's all a big cover-up, Michael. It's all outrageous. I mean, it's really disturbing. It was obviously a huge week or last 2 weeks of revelation of documents that we've been hoping to get unredacted for many years now, particularly the ACLU, but the Center and Amnesty International and Physicians for Human Rights have had requests in for these documents, interestingly, way ahead of the journalists. I mean, no journalists have ever done very much on this. But what finally came out was a 50% redacted CIA Inspector's General report on the CIA interrogation techniques. It was done through 2004, so it doesn't include anything after that. It goes up to that. What was not given was the what's called the Office of Professional Responsibility report, which is the report on what the lawyers did. But focusing on the CIA Inspector General's report for 2004, what you see in the papers is that Eric Holder, our Attorney General, is supposedly, well, is going to and did appoint a guy named Durham to be the special prosecutor, not an independent prosecutor, a special prosecutor, and he's only to look at what we would call above-the-line torture. What I mean by above-the-line torture is everything at a certain line and below, which is abuse, torture, inhuman treatment, is not to be looked at because that, quote, was authorized by the CIA, by memos, by the president, by Rumsfeld, by every higher official in our government, and it's only those few lower-level CIA agents that supposedly went above the line of what the torture they were allowed to do that might be looked at by this, quote, special prosecutor. It's not a quote. It's a special prosecutor.
We're talking about the handful of rogue CIA agents that exceeded the boundaries. But let's talk about what the boundaries are, because I think this is what is so important.
Well, I think that's why this is a fraud, Michael. What they're saying is we're only going to go above those, as you said, were supposedly rogue that went beyond what the boundaries were. This investigation is complete BS, and why it's so disgusting is what we're about to talk about is what were the boundaries? What did Bush and company allow to occur? Not just allow, but in every detail, really laid out exactly how to torture people and how to abuse them.
And then monitored from the White House by the hour.
Overseen by managers, lawyers, and doctors,
right?
Each of these things. And when you think about these things, you know, we follow this closely at the center. The lawyers follow it. We all look at this, and you hear all this stuff is, well, was this legal under the torture convention? Was this not legal? Was this? It's like going through a rat through a maze trying to find a way through the language of these statutes. But it's all BS. Heidi?
Now, we're not just talking waterboarding, which everyone knows has been going on.
No, what we're talking about, here's what they allowed. And this is just, you can read this everywhere now. This is what they allowed. For example, 2 17-watt fluorescent bulbs illuminated each cell 24 hours a day. White noise, which is like just noise, was never to exceed 79 decibels. You could be doused with water that was 41 degrees, but only for 20 minutes at a stretch. You could then...
So that's water that's just above freezing for 20 minutes at a time.
Yeah, let me add some to this. 1,500 calories a day, which is a minimal diet. When you're first captured, they shave your head and your beard and put you in a diaper. The attention slap was allowed.
What's that?
When the interrogator first... When the interrogator first approaches interrogee. He slaps them across the face to get their attention.
Number of hours they could be kept in a box. 8 hours for the large box, 2 hours for the small box.
And that's like a coffin.
Right. The proper time when his enforced nudity should be ended and his clothes returned. And then, as Michael said, they're brought to a black site. Their head and face were shaved, stripped, photographed, sleep deprivation, a diet limited to ensure. And then, of course, in the end of this whole thing, and not the end, but then they can be laying up, put on a concrete floor, but then they said, no, you have to put a plastic sheet under them, and you can douse them with cold water for how many minutes? I forget.
Up to 20.
20 minutes. 20, and 41 then, degrees to induce hypothermia.
And that's not even waterboarding it, and then you can waterboard. So these are things that are allowed. And you have to ask yourself, you know, they keep saying, well, they give these, John, you, these complex formulas about legality and everything. But, you know, when you sit back and just take a step back, since when can you ever treat another human being like that anywhere in the world, in any country that would call itself civilized? Any country. Think about it. I mean, yes, people abuse this all the time, but do they do it from the top with legal memos detailing every single kind of thing you can do? No, they don't, because they don't. No one would argue that it's legal, except for the Bush administration, and now except for the Obama administration saying, well, we're not going to even look into that. We're going to look into somebody if you hit them with water, it's 39 degrees instead of 41, then we're going to allow it. Not allow it.
They're saying, well, these people were not going to prosecute the higher-ups because they were only following orders. They were acting in good faith. But I think that these practices were first implemented, and then the legal memorandums were written afterwards to justify what they were doing. So the lawyers like John Yoo should be prosecuted for this, and the people like Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush, who ordered these lawyers to write these rationalizations, should be prosecuted as well. But they're all being ignored. The only people that are going to be prosecuted are like the hillbillies on the night shift.
These few things that have come out
the rogues.
The headlines, the mock execution, the threats to kill the kids, those are bad. But those were the little things supposedly above the line.
Yeah.
In fact, all these legal memos, as we just said, it's complete BS, because how could anybody in the military, in the CIA, in the government, believe that you could pick a human being up anywhere in the world, put them into a so-called secret cell, and then do what we just said to them? Put them on the ground, little piece of plastic, throw water on them for 20 minutes at a time, take the temperature down, play the music, shave them, diaper them, put them in sleep deprivation, put them in isolation. How could anybody in the world believe you could treat another human being like that, no matter how many legal... I don't care if you had legal memos stacked from here to the moon. You can't do it. And I think that's why, in the end, people in this country at the higher level, these officials are going to be prosecuted in other countries, because this is completely unacceptable.
And illegal.
There is no bite to this special prosecutor.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
He's not a special prosecutor.
He's a special prosecutor, but a special prosecutor...
But he's not independent.
Right.
There's two kinds, a special prosecutor and an independent prosecutor. A special prosecutor reports to the Attorney General Holder everything he or she does. Yeah. So in this case, Durham will report everything he does to Holder, and Holder has said he will only look at people who did what he calls above-the-line torture, not below-the-line torture. And that we're only talking about, according to this report, a half a dozen investigations. And there's articles in the Times and papers every day saying this will be impossible. It's many years afterwards. Witnesses are gone. This is all they're talking about. So this so-called special prosecutor is not an independent prosecutor. He's under the literal thumb of Eric Holder, our attorney general.
Yeah, it's a sham and a diversion. And the bottom line is that this stuff is illegal. It's been illegal for many years. There's an American law against it. There's international law against it. That was what was ignored. They created their own laws, and now they're going to prosecute people who they say didn't go by their own laws.
But aside from the damage to this country and our reputation, we are now subject to other countries looking at us and saying, well, if the U.S. can do this, we can do it. And what credibility do we have anymore as a so-called human rights leader? We're not. We're a primary violator.
Yeah. That's correct. We're actually a completely primary, fundamental violator. I'll just read you, just to give you a sense of what this says. Here's the kinds of records they had to include, according to the top-level CIA and government people. The required records, the medical supervisors said, there were medical supervisors. This is a doctor.
Just like the Nazis, you know?
Right, exactly, Michael. I think included, quote, how long each application lasted, how much water was used in the process, how much realizing that much splashes off, how exactly the water was applied. This is to waterboarding. If a seal was achieved, if the naso or ORF part of your throat was filled, what sort of volume was expelled, how long was the break between applications, and how the subject looked in between each waterboarding treatment. When the doctors gauged what a drenching in a cold cell might do to a prisoner, they did their research, consulting various books like Wilderness Medicine, Survival in Cold Waters. I mean, this is really...
Can we find out who the physicians are? Because quite honestly, I think they should lose their license.
Remember, Mengele, Dr. Mengele. We should look for him in Argentina and Bolivia.
We should look for him in Arlington, Virginia.
No, that's right. The doctors we have, there's a whole... Actually, the center has a website. If you go to the Center for Constitutional website, we're following the doctors very closely, and there's a number of people in the both American Psychological Association as well as medical associations going after the doctors. But it's doctors, lawyers, officials, CIA, government, this whole thing, as I think as Michael pointed out, and it's a diversion to look at the few rogue guys, so-called rogue, which we're not even sure they were rogue, you know, when they threatened a guy with a gun. And one question that got asked on my listserv the other day, of course, is one of the threats, the above-the-line torture was to Khalik Sheikh Mohammed, I think, was they had his two children in custody, that they would harm or kill his children or something to him, something to that effect.
And then they waterboarded him like 100.
And then the question
times.
Is, where are those children and what's happened to them?
Yeah.
And you know, when you hear, remember, put this context of the threat to the children into what John Yoo said on a radio show when a friend of mine asked him, well, do you think the president could do anything in the name of national security, even crush the testicles of one of the children of the people you're interrogating? And you said, well, yes, he could. It depends on the circumstances, but yes. So think about that, and think about that the children of some of these people are still missing. So we're talking about a complete fraud that's being perpetrated on the American people, that Holder is somehow disagreeing with Obama and pushing prosecutions of the few rogue agents. It's a complete BS business. What's going on here is awful. Read the stuff. You can go on websites and find these actual, they're redacted heavily, these documents. We'll put them up on our website. One is at the Washington Post website, one is at the Independent, and another at the ACLU website as well.
Michael, I have a question. When the center and other organizations filed years ago to get copies of these, you said you asked for unredacted copies. Is that ever possible?
Well, unredacted or mostly unredacted. And what happened with this particular report is it was sent, they first gave a very redacted copy to the request that was by the ACLU CCR, Physicians for Human Rights. And then the judge sent it back to actually having them include more. They issued it again without including very much more, still 50% redacted. And the people on my list sort of wonder what the heck is going on, because they say that they don't want to give the techniques to Al-Qaeda and everybody like that because it'll help them. But think about it. If they're not supposed to use these techniques anymore, supposedly, why would they care what comes out? Well, they claim now that it'll inflame Al-Qaeda and all that.
The techniques are published on the first page of the New York Times. These are not secret techniques.
But there may be techniques worse than what we're even hearing about that we can't imagine.
Well, the worst one is what Al McCoy talked to us about years ago, and that's total sensory deprivation. The CIA spent hundreds of millions of dollars using the best universities in America and Canada to learn that if you totally deprive people of any of their senses, you can break down the human spirit in a very short
like
time.
48
and that's
hours
why we see people with blindfolds and earphones on and gloves on. You know, you see when they've been captured. That's according to the CIA plan, to isolate them within their own brain and make them go crazy.
Here's one of the defenders of the program. David Rifkin, who writes a lot about defending this program, used to work for the Reagan administration. He says, quote, elaborate care went into figuring out the precise gradations of coercion.
Yeah.
Yes, it's jarring, but it shows how both the lawyers and the non-lawyers tried to do the right thing.
Yeah.
In other words, that they looked so precisely at how they tortured people. Heidi?
And determining that slight threshold, which for every individual is different. But even the fact that we're discussing this is stunning.
Well, you know what it reminds me of,
violates all norms of human rights law.
The banality of evil, the famous book that Hannah Arendt wrote. You know, for a guy like this to talk about the gradations of torture is the banality of evil.
You know, I actually I have trouble, as I said earlier, I have trouble even beginning to understand this at all, because it's all so outside of how any human being should be treated in any kind of context that we've known for hundreds of years, that it's hard to understand how they can just say, well, we're just going to go after the people who went above what we said could be done to you in the employment of torture. It's so incredible to me. I can't get my hands around
it. Let me shift the discussion here for a second and ask you this question, Heidi. The defense of all this stuff is Cheney's defense. To a certain extent, we have to use this. How much we have to use depends, but only using this gives us security. Heidi, do you think that that kind of defense line has been sold effectively to the American people?
Well, we remember back in Nixon's days when the Supreme Court held that the president could not overreach in the name of national security. And what I think has happened since the Nixon days is a continuing diminution in the eyes of the public about faith in government. And so I think combined with what we see on TV and in the media of corruption and really anything goes and it's all war, 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 us against them, the vilification of others, I think the mass media, less than scrupulous standards of those in power, has brought us to a really dangerous point where people just have no faith in those who were elected to take charge of this government. And so I think I am stunned that the public isn't taking to the streets about this. But we haven't seen that. We've seen the suppression of any outrage toward government so systematized over the last couple of decades that I think there's a general apathy about it. Torture has become commonplace.
I think that's right, Heidi. I mean, it's all like it is right that people just it's shocking.
Sort of like the Stockholm syndrome. You rationalize when someone who say has abducted you, very quickly they say the person to sort of rationalize being in this awful predicament takes the side of that person. And I wonder if a variation of that is happening.
I want to go back to that question Michael asked about Cheney. Cheney had up until revelation of these documents said that, well, if some of these documents come out, it'll demonstrate that these, quote, what he calls enhanced interrogation techniques, what we call torture, were necessary and we got good intelligence from people by using these enhanced interrogation techniques. Now, Cheney last week issued a statement after the revelation of these documents and the two that he had been demanding that he claimed would support that torture works. And here's what he said, and it's a very interesting couple of sentences. Cheney said, the documents released Monday, this is last Monday, clearly demonstrate that the individuals, listen carefully, that the individuals subjected to enhanced interrogation techniques provided the bulk of intelligence we gained about Al-Qaeda. The detainees also, according to these documents, played a role in the capture of nearly every Al-Qaeda. But listen to this language, that the individuals subject to these techniques provided the bulk of intelligence. As the articles coming out now on this statement who've analyzed Cheney's statement, they call it a walk back by Cheney. Because if you listen carefully, what Cheney doesn't do is connect enhanced interrogation techniques to the bulk of intelligence that was gotten. All he says is the bulk of intelligence was gotten from the high-value detainees. He doesn't say that it was the result of the enhanced interrogation techniques. And when you read the documents, it clearly was not the result of the enhanced interrogation techniques. So all that Cheney's saying, as some of the journalists said, this one, Greg Sargent said, all Cheney's saying is that the same individuals who were tortured also happened to yield the most important evidence about Al-Qaeda. He's not saying that the documents prove torture was responsible for providing that info. So these documents actually put to lie that Cheney's claim that the torture somehow gained information.
Even worse, Heidi, you remember the person they tortured who gave evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and that was used at the UN speech to justify the war against Iraq. And then it turned out that the evidence was totally false. And the only reason he gave it was he was being tortured. It's even worse. It's not only that torture doesn't work, that torture yields false evidence. And in this case, they used it to launch the war.
Exactly. That puts us in a worse situation. We all know that torture doesn't work. We've had so many experts on this show to talk about that. But someone desperate will say anything to get out of the situation.
And I think your point, Michael's point about the Iraq war, with one of the earliest uses of torture was to apparently just get the information from some supposed informer or somebody, a turncoat,
to use his justification.
Use justification for the war in Iraq, and was all BS. It was Powell relied on at the UN speech.
That's right.
And it was all a way of selling the war to the American public. So it's been a very, very bad couple of weeks on the torture issue. You're seeing a bit of scrambling by the administration with the so-called special prosecutor who's not independent, but you're seeing a complete ignoring, and worse than ignoring, of the torture program in the United States. And I say worse than ignoring because as soon as you only prosecute people who've gone above the line, above the torture line that they have, what are you saying about the torture below the line, except that it was okay?
And business as usual.
Right. And so it's a very bad set of circumstances.
But I think we have to say that but for organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights, the work that the Lawyers Guild did on it, the good work that the ACLU did on it, none of this would have come out. And you wouldn't even have the marginal investigation that you have now.
So it's absolutely critical that we keep this fight up. And I think ultimately that other courts in the world will go after the U.S. for this. But this is a setback. I consider this a 500-year setback. Then when the major country in the world, the most important country from an economic and military point of view, and supposedly for human rights, although I think that's quite questionable, really invokes and becomes part of a torture program and conspiracy, then what can you say about any other country in the world that follows the United States lead? Yeah, no, and essentially, it set back civilization hundreds of years.
Yeah, I think it's a setback, too. I think that what Obama's done is tied a pretty pink bow on this whole torture program. And this diversion will peter out because these prosecutions, to the limited extent that they're even looking into it, aren't going to happen. And the whole thing will be put aside. No one will be held accountable for the torture program that this country carried out for all those years under Cheney and Bush.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Pleased to welcome a special guest to Law & Disorder today, Jake Ratner, just off the plane from over 3 months in Bolivia. Jake is entering his final year at the University of Pennsylvania and is going to share with us some of what he experienced in Bolivia, including socialism, indigenous life, prison life, and more, including comparisons between Bolivia and Cuba. Jake, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
You just got back from Bolivia. Why were you down there?
I was down in Bolivia for about 2.5 months, and as part of my work for school, I was working at a women's prison. It's called COF. It's the Centro de Obrajes Femenina. I was working in the women's prison with an organization, an ONG, an NGO called Semilla de Vida. What they do is they do a variety of activities there, from installing new light fixtures, to teaching workshops, to installing a kindergarten program, and I was working through them on a number of different projects in the women's prison.
What would you have a kindergarten program for in a prison?
Well, that's an interesting question. Prisons down there work very differently than they do here. Legally, up to the age of 6, women are allowed to keep their children with them in prison. And it's a highly debated issue among the government ministry that controls the prisons, but among the women as well. Some women think it's a really good positive practice, and others think it's kind of a shame that their kids have to serve the sentence that they're serving. But legally, until the age of 6, the kids can live there with the women, and often it's the best option for the kids. The women often have husbands in a men's prison, The other options for the kids are not actually as good. An orphanage in a poor country like Bolivia is often a lot worse of a place than the prison.
It sounds that already from what you've told us that prison life down there must be more humane than it is here in the United States. Had you been to any prisons in this country and had a point of comparison?
No, I'm excited to go back and compare the two, but I can't imagine it's anything like the prison system down there. The famous prison is San Pedro Men's Prison in La Paz, and it runs unlike any prison I've ever heard of in my life. Guards aren't allowed to enter the prison. They stand on the outside, and the prison is a self-functioning prison where prisoners run hotels, they run small businesses, and they have to pay rent for their cells. And they have soccer teams, and it's completely different. And that kind of sense of autonomy I also felt in the women's prison, where the guards have their own quarters separated, and the director of the prison is far removed from inside the prison walls. And when you go in, it seems like a small Bolivian village. There's a fountain, there's kids running around, there's women selling sweets and chocolates.
A couple of questions on that, Jake.
Of course.
One is, do you think that relates, the way they run prisons, to the sort of what I think you perceive as a communal culture of the Aymara and the Quechua people in Bolivia?
Right. And we can get into that later. But exactly, the spirit of rebellion in the prison is something that is completely related to their culture of a long history of rebellion starting in 1781 with Tupac Katari against the Spanish and continuing to the present. It's always been a culture of collective reasoning and collective resistance to the imposing power. And you can completely feel that within the prison walls. Once I got there at about 10 in the morning on a Monday, and the women were amassed together, about 50 of them, confronting the guards and yelling at them and asking for the prison captain to be removed. They felt that she'd been treating them unfairly, that she used to have her office inside the prison walls and used to relate to them, but recently she'd moved outside and had been transferring women from the Miraflores prison, which is a higher security prison for women who have committed greater crimes. And women were upset about the transfers, and they had decided to come together, and they were confronting the guards, and there was nothing the guards could do. There was 5 guards and 50 or 60 women yelling at them, and eventually
there's no guns or anything, right?
There's no guns or anything.
And I bet there's not the kind of brutality, if any, that we have pervasive in the U.S.
Well, it's actually, some of the women talk a lot about the issue of brutality there, because the guards are trained as soldiers, and when they lead the women out to their different hearings, they handcuff them and they treat them very harshly. But within the prison walls, of course, there's not brutality because the guards in prison hardly ever interact.
One question I had, what are the women doing there? What kind of crimes did they commit?
Well, most of the women, they're waiting for sentencing. The sentencing procedures are long and tiresome, and the judge often don't show up to the hearings. Many women have been there 3 years just waiting to be sentenced. But that said, the majority of them, about 70-75%, are there for narcotráfico, the drug trade. Many of them, they said, acted as mules, carrying small packages of cocaine, either to around Bolivia or trying to smuggle it out of the country.
So your prison work was down in La Paz, right? And then you had a commute from where you lived, which was an hour and a half on minibuses, from a place called El Alto, which is a city up another 1,000 feet that has also about 900,000 people, mostly Aymara people, up above La Paz. Now, can you tell us a little bit about what is El Alto? Where did you live?
Sure.
What was that community like?
Yeah, I didn't want to live in the city. Most gringos, when they go down there, live in the Sopocachi area, which is called the Greenwich Village of La Paz. And I wanted to live in El Alto, which sits another 1,000 feet above La Paz at about 14,000 feet. And it's the Altiplano. It's a large plateau. And the city of El Alto sits about an hour and a half from La Paz. So my commute every day was quite long in a small minibus, a small van that I had to take to descend down into the city. The city of El Alto has about 800,000 residents currently. Probably an underestimation, and La Paz, which has about over 1 million, is soon going to be overtaken by the population of El Alto. But El Alto is just kind of an urban sprawl that sits on the top of the plateau. I lived there with an Aymara family. 92% of the population of El Alto is Aymara because they come from the various regions of Tiwanaku and smaller surrounding communities that speak Aymara. Aymara is one of two major indigenous groups in Bolivia, though there are, I think, officially 30-something. But Quechua and Aymara are the two major groups.
And what was life like up there? I mean, was it compared to life in La Paz or compared to life here? Is it Bolivia is the second poorest country in the hemisphere after Haiti. And El Alto, I think, is considered...
People say the poorest city
in Bolivia, right? So you're talking about extreme poverty in a certain way.
You are, but at first glance, it doesn't seem like extreme poverty, which it took me a while to kind of reconcile. When I was in Cuba, I studied there for about 4.5 months in 2008. When you visited a slum on the outside of Cuba of ilegales, of people who were not allowed to get residence for the city of Havana, it looks like a lot more depressed place. There are tin roofs and small tiny houses next in a sprawling kind of what you would imagine a typical slum. But El Alto doesn't really look like that. The buildings are larger. They're adobe brick. And what kind of I began to realize after living there for about 2.5 months is that at first it might not seem like such an impoverished place, but the type of slum that existed in Cuba wouldn't be able to exist in El Alto. It's freezing cold there at night. The temperature drops below freezing.
In El Alto.
In El Alto. The wind is extremely strong, blowing.
There's not a tree on the entire Alto Plano. I mean, you can go from where you were in El Alto 100 miles to Lake Titicaca and right. south 100, and there's nothing, not a tree.
Yeah, exactly. So... that's part of the problem, too, is that people then have to use gas and can't burn firewood. But you quickly realize that it's just as poor a place as you can imagine.
Is there plumbing where you were?
There is not plumbing. The statistics for plumbing are still pretty bad. But it's hard for the city government to keep up because the population has just grown at an exponential rate for years. El Alto's about 26 years old, they say, even though people have been living there since Tupac Katari.
Which was 17.
Yeah, 1781, he descended and took the siege of La Paz. Starting in about 26 years ago in the 1980s, when a lot of factories had to close down and mines had to shut down when the price of tin dropped, the city just expanded at an enormous rate.
And the family you lived with was essentially a traditional family. The woman was a market woman who wore the typical chola clothes, is that right?
Yeah, almost all the women. That's a major difference between the city of La Paz and the district of El Alto, is all the women there wear the traditional chola clothing.
What did you eat there?
They eat a lot of freeze-dried potatoes, chuño and tunta, they're called. One of them is just made from letting the potato sit in the frost, and the other one is they let it sit in a river, but it can last a really long time.
And this was actually the first frozen food invented by, the Aymara or the Incas or whatever, where they would leave their potatoes out all year, I guess, or something.
And
when you say frozen food, it's not frozen like a package like...
No, it's more like freeze-dried.
But it's left outside. They leave their potatoes outside.
Right.
One of the things I noticed in El Alto, and of course Michael and I who study and look at Che Guevara a lot, when you come into El Alto, there's this huge steel sculpture of Che Guevara. And, I took pictures of it and I sent them to Michael and we started thinking about it. But there's some controversy, and I think it relates to the next subject we want to talk about is political change in Bolivia, which is the statue of Che is there, but there's some controversy about having Che there rather than...
Tupac Katari. Yeah, there was a large fight.
So why don't you talk about who is Tupac Katari and what's this fight really about?
Che is definitely still a respected figure there. And all the boys, the young boys in the house I was living with, there's three adolescent boys, they all have pictures of Che, and he's a revered hero for them. But still, there was this statue that they were going to build in the center of La Ceja, which is the first stop in El Alto. It's like the transit hub in the downtown. And there was a fight for a long time of whether they should have an indigenous leader, Tupac Katari, or a kind of more general symbol of socialism in Che Guevara. And I think that's kind of representative of a really important point about trying to look at socialism and looking at the changes that have been made under the Evo administration in Bolivia. Using the word socialism to describe the kind of changes in Bolivia, which is the term used, the party of Evo is called MAS, Movimiento al Socialismo, Movement Towards Socialism. People talk here from a Western perspective of socialism happening currently under the Evo administration. But you have to take socialism, I think, in a slightly different context when it's applied to Bolivia. Like we were talking about before, is the indigenous communities organized in a way that would be considered socialist in some way, especially in the more rural communities. For example, both extremes are looked down upon if you don't work and if you're lazy, it's highly looked down upon. But also if you're kind of consumerist and care about material possessions, that's also highly looked down upon. And I thought this was an interesting practice that's kind of representative of this kind of small community socialism, is that when the richest person in the village is overspending and lavishing themselves in various goods, the community gets together and elects that person to be their representative. Now, they don't do that because they respect this person. They do it because as their representative, the person will have to travel, the person will have to put on campaigns and spend their money, and then by the end of the year, this person will be moved from the top earning member of the community down towards a more middle level. In a way that you can consider that socialism, but the word should be taken with a grain of salt because it's really just a community practice that has been done from...
So go back to Qatari and Che and how they illustrate some of that point. What was that fight really about?
Right. Exactly. That's kind of representative of what I was talking about, is that Tupac Qatari was the indigenous leader who fought against the Spanish, laid siege to the city of La Paz for a number of months until the army arrived from the viceroyalty of Rio de la Plata. He was really the beginning of this indigenous struggle that has taken place for the last 280 years in Bolivia.
As opposed to Che.
As opposed to Che Guevara, who came in as an extranjero, as a foreigner, and tried to take this idea of socialism that had been applied to Cuba, start a revolution in Bolivia. Now, there's a number of reasons why that didn't work, but most notably is at that time, the peasants were kind of allied more with a right-leaning government, but also just that, well, like we were talking about, his ideas of socialism didn't necessarily match up with their ideas. And I think you can kind of see that already in the Evo administration versus the Fidel administration in the beginning couple years. Is you look at the agrarian reform that happened in Cuba and you compare it to the agrarian reform that happened in Bolivia. In Cuba, they divided up huge parcels of land and confiscated land, and the same with nationalization. They really nationalized the companies and kicked out all U.S. investment. In Bolivia, people criticize it for happening at a much slower rate. The nationalization was 51% of the companies rather than a full nationalization as happened in Cuba. The agrarian reform that they praise so highly really hasn't taken away any land. It's legally allowed to take away land that's not in use and unproductive, as opposed to Cuba, where land was just taken away from the large landowners. So people do criticize the Evo administration for going at a much slower pace and implementing changes differently. But when you take it within the context of what I was talking about earlier, indigenous kind of socialism and community organizing, you really see that he is in line with a lot of their beliefs and not necessarily, though, in line with the more Western traditional aspect of socialism that we think about.
One thing that, you know, when I visited you there recently, you know, I learned a lot about at least this relationship of indigenous power and socialism. But one thing that I never realized, and I think a lot of people here in the U.S. don't realize, is that in 2003, at least some writers say that Bolivia had a revolution, essentially. And can you say, what did they mean by that? Did people in El Alto do something? What was the 2003 Bolivian revolution?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Evo came to power in 2006. So the 2003 revolution is known as the Gas Wars. And what happened... I guess it was sparked by a number of different reasons, but similar to what we were talking about, a various community in, had decided to implement their own community justice. They had found a couple cattle rustlers and had taken justice into their own hands. And the leader of the community, who was just representing the general population sentiment, was then put in jail under the González Sánchez de Llosada administration, or who they call GONI. And that began kind of a little bit of unrest where people thought that the government was kind of controlling their autonomy that they had had for a number of years. And then the final straw, I guess, was when they found out that behind closed doors, GONI had been trying to negotiate a deal with various oil companies to export the natural gas, which is Bolivia's main resource. These negotiations had been happening since 1997, but in 2003, they were completed, and the natural gas was going to be exported through Chile to California. And people went crazy. People...
Particularly the indigenous communities, which is some 60% of Bolivia.
Right. The indigenous communities. But this was also the first time where kind of the indigenous movement, which has always been prevalent, kind of matched the demands of the national popular movement, of the liberals, of the students, of the miners, who have always been kind of two separate movements going often for different goals that contradict each other. But in 2003, these goals matched and both joined together and descended thousands, hundreds of thousands of people from El Alto descended down to the city to basically take over the city.
Yeah, now it's unimaginable to me when I sit here and hear that, that your first point, which is, of course, that the, what you'd call the workers' movements, miners, et cetera, combined with the indigenous movements, which was a huge thing. And then that the idea of a 250,000 or 200,000 people coming down into La Paz and doing what? Just completely
taking over the city
of La Paz. Yeah. And that was the end of the president of Gonzalo de la Lozada, wasn't
it? Well, what happened exactly was that he met force or he met the popular uprising with force. And the numbers of people killed vary on depending on who you ask, but confirmed over 60 people were killed and hundreds injured. That force from the government hadn't been seen for a long time, and people, it just sparked the movement. It just continued the movement with more strength.
That, I mean, it not only resulted in eventually Evo's victory and the indigenous victory, which wasn't really expected, I think. Is that right?
No, it wasn't expected at all. People didn't think Evo really had a chance, even in 2005, 2006.
So it resulted in that victory. It also resulted in a couple of lawsuits, one that my office, the Center for Constitutional Rights, is doing against the former president who killed the people during the Bolivian uprising, revolution. And that's pending in New York, but there's also in Florida, but there's also one going on in Bolivia as well against some of the ministers. What's going on with that?
Right. There are two different lawsuits. There's one happening here, which some of the lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights are working on. And there's also a lawsuit contra Goni, against Goni, in Sucre, in the capital of Bolivia. The lawsuit is targeting his ex-ministers as well as him for the killings that happened in the 2003 uprising. And for the Bolivian people, I can't speak for them, obviously, but the people I've talked to down there really view the lawsuit as a very important change, as kind of getting rid of the old. A lot of people had no relatives who were injured or killed in the 2003 uprising and the backlash that followed from the government. And for them, they really see it as this kind of more symbolic rather than anything. Goni is now in the United States, and they understand that it might not really do much good to prosecute him there. But for people there, it's kind of, symbolic, or at least what I understood, of kind of like a new beginning, wiping away of the past and getting a purging of the old system and starting over with the new indigenous leader.
And one of the other, that's one of the results, of course, of the gas wars and the revolution along with Evo. But there's another practice that has caused a lot of discussion is something called bonos.
There's five different bonos, and these are kind of the payments that, similar to Social Security, that the government gives to its population. There's a bono for...
This was only under Evo. There were no bonos before Evo, right?
No. A bono is exactly a payment that the government gives to a population that it feels is underprivileged or in need. And part of the bonos, there's one for school children, is to encourage children to go to school and not to work at a young age. There's a bono for infants. There's a bono for the elderly. And the bonos are actually very small payments. For example, for a school child, it's about 200 bolivianos a year that you get as a bono, which is roughly $28. $28 is somewhat in Bolivia. It's enough to buy seeds and other things. But it's really just more, I think, symbolic for people. And when you ask people, what do you think of the bonos, people think this is great, that finally they're seeing their natural resource that they consider theirs, obviously the natural gas. Finally, they're seeing some of the profits of it, where for as long as they can remember and as long as their parents can remember, it has just been taken from them and sold to the United States or to other Western countries.
I mean, there's obviously a lot of discussion about Evo, and I find when I was there for the 10 days I was there, it's very complex because of the relationship of an indigenous power that has finally taken power after 500 years, and then our Western idea of putting a socialist front cover on it as well. But what's the feeling from what you could see about Evo? Is there a left of Evo? Give us some sense of, I know it's a very complex, so it's hard to give final answers, but just some thoughts.
Right. Well, like I was saying, people are very pleased with the bonos and the money they're seeing from the nationalization of the gas, because that's where the financing for the bonos came from. So when you ask people, like the family I was living with in El Alto, what do you think of Evo? It's a lot of praise you hear. You hear that he's doing good for us, that now I can help clothe my child with the money I get for every month from the bonos. So people are generally, I think, pretty pleased in the indigenous population, but there's obviously some criticism too, and people aren't 100% positive about the bonos. People think that the bonos might be a nice to have a small amount of money, but the kids of the family I was living with said that they get their bonos for going to school, but they don't get to see any of the money. It doesn't go to their school clothes. It usually just ends up being used for whatever they need around the house. I was talking to one of the older boys who works at the legal office, who works at a legal office in La Paz, and his criticism of the bonos was they could do a lot more with the money that they've gotten from the nationalization of the gas, that they could build more infrastructure, they could build daycare centers, and rather than just give small parcels of the money away to people, he was in favor of using the money in a larger bunch to make bigger changes.
Now, my last question, and then I'll let Michael go here, is there's an election coming up again for the presidency, and Evo's going to run again. When is that election, and what are his chances?
That election is in December, and everybody thinks and knows that Evo will win. While there might be a kind of a strong conservative base in Santa Cruz and what they call the Half Moon area, right now they don't have a candidate that can compete with Evo. They don't even really have a candidate that they're all backing together. And if you ask anyone there, people say Evo has a very good chance of winning.
Jake, can you talk about the U.S.'s so-called war on drugs? And did you see anything of how it impacted the people you met?
Yeah. The legacy of the U.S.'s war on drugs I still think is very prevalent in Bolivia. Even though President Evo Morales comes from the Coca Growers Union and in his speech at the U.N. held up a coca leaf and said, "This is cocoa, this is coca, this is not cocaine." And we use it here to chew, we use it here to alleviate hunger when we're working in the mines and food is scarce. One would think that he's very a major change from the policies that have been implemented during the U.S. on the war on drugs. However, working in the women's prison and seeing that 75% of them are there for narcotráfico and talking to the directors of the NGO I was working for, the laws they say on drugs haven't really changed. There's still extremely harsh penalties similar to the Rockefeller drug laws in New York where people for possessing a tiny amount of cocaine, there's women who are going to be in the prison for 15, 20 years. And so while coca might be accepted, cocaine is not, and the legacy of the U.S. drug intervention still continues.
Jake, if you were Bolivian and not an American, and you were active in politics down there as a young man, what kind of organizations do people involve themselves in?
Well, this is really interesting, and this is a major difference between there and the United States, is that right from the start, kids are always involved in various political groups, and that doesn't happen here to the same extent at all. The major group in El Alto is called FACE, the Federación de Estudiantes Secundarias. So every kid in high school is a member of that organization. As soon as they are 13 and join high school, they become active in various different groups. The three boys that I was living with were in another group. They're active in a group called the ASONAT, which is the young workers group of El Alto. And they fight for workers' rights and against exploitation of children who are under the age of 14, who you see everywhere having to work for various jobs. That was one of the saddest things for me when I was there, was seeing 12-year-olds, not even younger, 8-year-olds, working on the minibuses as the person who opens the door and collects the money. Every person I met there was involved in some youth organization and fighting for some kind of change that they believed in.
What was the response of the people you met to you being down there?
Yeah. I think in a couple ways. You were the only, as far as I know, the only gringo really living in your area of El Alto, right?
Right?
So
exactly.
I think it's
for
a good question.
The 2.5 months I was there, I didn't see another gringo. And people thought it was very strange. People, while they were nice and somewhat accepting, especially the family I was living with, I've never seen such kindness from anyone I met. They took me right in. They made me feel at home. They treated me like a son. And that helped within the smaller neighborhood community I was in. Even though El Alto is a large city, it's still kind of very neighborhood-oriented. And a lot of people who come from the villages in the Tiwanaku region move to an area of El Alto and kind of take over an entire neighborhood. So smaller village dynamic is definitely still prevalent within the neighborhoods. And living with the family, the neighborhood community was more accepting. People said hi to me and, treated me, I think, much better than most gringos get treated there. I had a friend who was doing his research on the Bonos, and he had to conduct many interviews in El Alto. And people, he said, were really harsh to him. He said he encountered a lot of anti-white sentiment. When he was asking, people didn't want to talk to him. People refused to answer his questions. And I never really had that experience. I was also working in the city, so my work didn't really involve the local community organizations. I did for about a week and a half when I first got down there try to work in the El Alto, government. It's actually called the Asamblea de Derechos Humanos, the Assembly for Human Rights. And I worked there for about a week and a half. But I found that trust is a very hard thing to come by in Bolivia for a gringo. I can completely understand why there's been a long legacy of U.S. intervention, USAID, and people at the Human Rights Office really wouldn't trust me with larger assignments. They gave me menial tasks and small amounts of research. And while they were accepting enough to let me in through various phone calls, and the work they gave me was never really what I wanted it to be.
Now, you speak beautiful Spanish. Were you fluent before you went down?
I wasn't. I actually speak very bad Spanish.
No, Jake,
because I studied at the University of Havana, where the Spanish is, at least my imitation of it, is unintelligible to the Bolivians.
But, of course, you gave up a lot of your Cuban accent when you went to Bolivia, right?
I guess so, yeah.
I mean, I've drawn this out before, not just with your accent, but, you know, you spent, within your 1 year, you spent 3 months in three or four months in Cuba and 3 months almost in Bolivia.
Right.
And so you've gotten to see one very established socialist society and one, as at least Amas, is moving towards socialism in some way. Are there any other reflections you have on those two experiences?
Yeah, that was extremely interesting for me to compare what I saw in Cuba and what I saw in Bolivia. It just seemed to me in Cuba that the government not cared more about its population but was doing more for its population, where even though I saw small slums of people who were not considered legal within the system, the majority of the people I met had so much more provided for them.
In Cuba.
Yeah. They have milk till they were seven. They had the paint for their house. They had medical care. And even though in Bolivia medical care is relatively cheap and subsidized, it still costs people 15, 20 bolivianos, which is $3 or $4, to go to a doctor to be a consultant. There's actually Cuban clinics that have been a great success in Bolivia, but they're primarily offering eye care right now and not doing more general medical care. But in contrast, like I was saying about Bolivia before, is that it just seems the government has more of a mentality of here, take a small amount of money and fend for yourself. And it's harder because Bolivia is a much more depressed country than Cuba is, and the population has much less. But in Cuba, there was more of a distinct feeling where the government does care about you and is trying to do more to better your general life.
I have an anecdote, Jake, and then also another question for you. The anecdote is, Michael and I have been working on a book on how the CIA and the American government were complicit with the Bolivian dictatorship back in the mid-60s and tracking down and ultimately murdering Che. And the person that pulled the trigger and shot Che, killed Che, was a drunken Bolivian army sergeant named Mario Taran. And I read recently that Mario Taran was the recipient of Cuban health care, that he had cataracts, and he went into one of these clinics that the Cubans had provided in Bolivia, and he got his cataracts taken care of. While you were there, the coup took place in Honduras, a coup that seems that the United States is going along with, certainly isn't doing anything to reverse. And I wondered whether there was any kind of consciousness or discussion in Bolivia about what I think was a major setback for the movement for democracy in Latin America.
Yeah, there was definitely some amount of discussion among the radio stations. And my family would play the radio at night, and there was an Aymara radio station that would often talk about the coup. And they were absolutely upset by it. They thought that, I guess they kind of likened it to what happened to them in 2003, where the government was just kind of imposing its will on them. And they saw it as kind of an imposition of government power against a majority that they could absolutely relate to.
Jake, what are your plans now that you've returned?
Finishing school, for starters. You're a fourth year at Penn, right?
Yeah, I have another year at Penn. It's hard to come back from that environment to here. There's so many things that you so easily forget about, and part of you wants to just jump back into the culture that I live, the excessive material culture and lifestyle that I live. And it's absolutely been hard for me to come back and have this desire for material possessions or even just a warm shower or anything that there I was able to kind of like forget about and just think about things on such a more basic, different level. And that's kind of been upsetting to me, is that I can come back here and so easily slip back into old patterns. Or
when my sister Linda came back from Iran, she was working there as a teacher, and she came back and she was so shocked to see the sort of life that people live in this country, particularly in the big cities of this country, that she went and got a job on the border of Arizona and New Mexico, working teaching English as a second language at an Indian reservation and living in a trailer. And she lived out there for several years as kind of a transition to get back into this place.
Yeah, I think you need some kind of transition like that, because I had a similar experience coming back from Cuba, but just the culture shock, or I guess reverse culture shock is what they call it, is pretty extreme.
Jake, it's been fabulous to have you on.
Thank you very much.
We wish you luck in your continued endeavors, and we know that you will be working for social good, runs in the family.
Splendid guest on Law and Disorder.
Yes,
thank you very much, Jake Ratner.
Come be a co-host anytime.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.